Good morning, and thanks for joining us. So today, our guest is a teacher and writer, Peter Green. He has spent 39 years as a high school English teacher, which is a lifetime. Peter also writes an incredible blog on education policy called Curmudgeducation, and you can find it at curmudgeducation.blogspot.com. He also writes about education for Forbes magazine and The Progressive, leaving no demographic stone unturned. Thank you for joining us, Peter. So I wanted to ask you a few questions. One, how did you end up writing for both Forbes and The Progressive?
It was just... In both cases, I had made contacts with people who were regular readers of the Curmudgeducation, the mothership, and they kind of reached out to me and asked if I was interested, and I was. So it was two different avenues, but it was kind of the same process.
It's wonderful to read the articles in both of them. One thing you've written about in your blog and also for Forbes is that... this summer, the U.S. Supreme Court has decided to hear a church and state case, Espinoza versus the Montana Department of Revenue. And why should we be paying attention to this?
This case is going to be, and it's an important case because it's going to have an effect on how solid the wall between church and state remains. Particularly when it comes to schools, it came out of a situation in many cases, in many states, and actually the push is being made again nationally. One of the types of vouchers that people have come up with is what's called a tax shelter or a tax. It's a workaround for taxes, so that if I'm a business, I can give my money almost directly to the school of my choice as a scholarship, and that counts for my taxes that I'm owed to the state, so that rather than giving my money to the state, I give it to a particular school. This has been used in some states as a way to aim tax dollars at religious schools. And of course, in many states, what are known as the Blaine Amendments forbid any direct handing of tax dollars to schools, but this is kind of a workaround. But in Montana, even though they wanted to do a very small tax scholarship credit, their particular state government said, no, that's not okay. That violates separation of church and state. And so it's been pushed up to the Supreme Court. If the court finds in favor of this, then what we're going to see is an easier and more readily available method for tax dollars to go to private religious schools.
Well, one of the things we have in Arizona, and it was definitely in response to vouchers going to religious schools, the courts here said that was illegal. It violated, you know, the separation of church and state and the commitment that we had when we joined the United States to fully fund public education. But we have a variety of things. One is that we have corporate tax credits, and these are dollar for dollar refunds for making a contribution to a private school. And last year, one of the big companies, Geico, made a contribution of $6 million to two religious schools. And all across the state, the newspapers were saying, isn't this great? They're so generous. You know, they're so wonderful to do this. In reality, it was a great deal for them because it meant they paid $6 million less in taxes.
Yes. In one state, Georgia, and they've been fiddling with their laws about this, in Georgia, a company could actually make a profit. You could give $1 million to a school and end up with about a 10% profit on that $1 million, so that you actually made money. And of course, in the meantime, the other piece of this, and we're all meant to kind of have our attention directed away from this, the other piece of that is that when, you know, in your case, when Geico gave $6 million to those schools, that was $6 million that the state did not get. You know, that blows a $6 million hole in the state budget, which has to be made up for either in terms of more taxes or cuts.
Right. And in Arizona right now, we have so many tax credits, not just schools, but other things. Like, for example, if you have, you live out of state and you have an airplane and you park it here, you get a tax credit. If you own your own plane and you live here, you don't get that tax credit. Anyway, our current state budget is about $11 billion, and our tax credits are $13 billion. And all I can say is the, you know, with the state with the lowest funding for per pupil spending and teacher pay, we could certainly use to double our budget. So when one of the things that's going on in Arizona is that we are spending more and more money trying to divert money out of public schools. And this is, you know, we had a referendum last year where this, where 85% of the people said, no, we don't want more expansion into vouchers. And the legislature tried to pass about six bills this session trying to do just that. There seems to be a disconnect between what the people want and what our policymakers want.
And that's not an uncommon problem. West Virginia is going through the same thing. Their teachers staged what was essentially a wildcat strike two school years ago, and got an agreement from the governor and the legislature that certain policies, including voucher and charter policies, wouldn't be pursued, and their legislature has continued to pursue those policies anyway. Their feeling has been that if they just package them with a raise for teachers, then the teachers would quietly accept it and it would be okay. But, I mean, I think what we're seeing in lots and lots of legislatures is that voters and taxpayers are not the primary constituencies of some of these folks. Some of them are well-funded by the usual suspects, folks like the Koch brothers. And in other cases, I think you see some real ideologues as well. You know, there are people who certainly believe that government should be doing little to nothing and that everything else should be funded privately. And if you can't convince someone in the private sector to fund your school, well, then you don't get a school. If you can't get someone in the private sector to fund your health care, then you don't get health care. It's a concept of freedom that says everybody's entitled to the rights that they can pay for.
Right. And it kind of, it's such a change from, we used to have this vision of, the common good, that we wanted parks in our communities. We wanted good schools in our communities for all children to go to. And now that is not really the case. And, you know, schools used to be the kind of mixing ground, the true melting pot in our country, where you could meet kids who didn't look at all like you. And we are becoming more and more separate with this expansion of vouchers and charter schools.
Well, and there's always been, you know, pressure back against that idea of mixing everybody. You know, and after Brown versus Board of Education, all over the South, and not just all over the South, but the South was most notable, immediately we have what were called segregation academies, which were early private schools that let you pull your white kid out of a public school where they might meet some of the children of those people. The issue of busing has come up again, busing and desegregation, and there has always been pushback against fixing those issues in this country. And in some ways, charters and vouchers and the choice movement that movement is hard to pin down because it involves a lot of people who are involved for a lot of different reasons, but it certainly has empowered people whose vision of education is that they shouldn't have to send their kids to school with those people's kids. They shouldn't have to spend their tax dollars on schools for those people's kids. That's certainly one of the things that's empowering this whole movement.
Right. And even though only in Arizona, it's 4% of students that attend private schools. So you'd think people would have a bigger vision of, you know, those 4% are not going to create the world we want to live in, and you might want to invest with some of the other kids. But that doesn't look like it's happening.
No, it's a spectacularly short-sighted vision. So I live and I taught in a small town, and it's the kind of place where you meet your former students on a daily basis. I mean, my taking care of my car, taking care of my yard, taking care of my health care, going out to eat. Everywhere I turn, I'm a customer of my former students. And so I was very conscious throughout my whole career that I was teaching the people that I was going to live next door to. And I was teaching the people who were going to be part of the community I was living in. And that gives you a very definite perspective on what a school is for.
Exactly. We're going to take a quick break right now, and we'll be back in about 2 minutes. We're speaking with Peter Green, who writes about education on his blog and also for Forbes magazine and The Progressive. We'll be right back. Hi, we're back. You're listening to Smart Talk with Robin and Al. I'm here today, and we're speaking with Peter Green, who is an incredible blogger. He blogs at kermeducation.blogspot.com, and he also writes for Forbes magazine and The Progressive. And one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, because I've noticed that in the past 24 months, there's been this change of view and a slew of apologies for people who in the past pushed for privatization. Cory Booker, President Obama, Joe Biden. And what do you think has caused this change? Oh, also people who spent billions of dollars giving money to schools or giving money to organizations that supported privatization.
Yeah, some of the big supporters have backed away from some of their policies, and some of the people who were kind of instrumental in formulating some of these policies have taken a step or two back away from them. I think there's several things going on. I think in some cases, they're simply dealing with the facts that they see. I mean, I think it's really easy from my side of things to start viewing everybody who's pushing sort of these packages of corporate reforms as evil and greedy and horns coming out of their head. And many of them, certainly not all of them, but at least some of them are, I think, actually honestly motivated by what they see as solutions for issues in education. And for some of those people, it's become impossible. You know, at this point, the data is so heavily stacked against, say, high-stakes testing. You know, we've seen repeatedly that there's no real useful feature of high-stake testing, that it doesn't tell us that getting a student to have a higher high-stakes test score does not mean they're going to have a better life as an adult. It's not going to lead to more improved life outcomes. And so some people are simply seeing that. You know, some of it is there's always been a steady shift in tactics. If you think back to the very beginning of modern ed reform, it was really common to slam teachers and kind of approach this from the attitude that the teachers in public schools were a bunch of incompetent boobs who had screwed everything up. And we needed to just kind of elbow them out of the way and take things over. And after a few years of that, a lot of ed reform folks came to realize that no, that was not only wrong, but was not a great tactic, because you needed teachers to cooperate and help implement some of the stuff you were bringing out there. And I think more recently, we're just seeing more and more people realize that the directions they've been pushing just haven't been working. I can't speak to Barack Obama's tweet, which was surprising and hasn't been followed up by any other information or comments. So I don't know whether a light bulb went off for him or not. You know, there were a lot of what we sometimes call neoliberals, and sometimes they get put under the same general banner as progressives, who for a long time pushed the idea that, that we could just educate our way out of poverty, that if we just gave everybody better schools, then suddenly poverty would end. And again, as time has gone on, it's become less and less possible to look at reality and still believe that that's true. And I think probably that's the biggest factor, reality. Reality just gets in your way when you're trying to believe a lot of this stuff.
Well, it's weird because the research has been showing this for years, and the research has just been dismissed. And so I have this theory that there were a lot of people on both sides of the aisle that supported this, which was shocking. And I think on the Democrat side, with the testing, they didn't want to look like they didn't want to hold people accountable, so they went along with it. But I think one of the things that's changed is Betsy DeVos. And I think when she came into power, into her appointment, all of a sudden people who were progressive but supported this privatization thought, whoa, this is where it's going, an end to public education. And they kind of woke up and said, maybe that's not what we're going for.
Well, I would hope that some of them woke up. I think that the shift in administration also resulted in a lot of people saying, oh, if I'm going to keep standing up for this, I'm now going to have to stand with Donald Trump and Betsy DeVos. And politically, that's just not a pleasant thought for me. So I'm going to try to find some way to make it look like there's some air between us. And some have tried harder and been more successful than others. But I do think that's certainly been a factor, that people are just trying to put some space between themselves. And it has been a problem for progressive because an awful lot of corporate education reform ideas have been, they basically have a conservative genesis, and they've largely been conservative pushed, and it was a helpful for their movement to get progressives and people on the left to sign on, but it's a lot harder for folks on the left to maintain that connection, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it is just a matter of who do you want to be politically allied with. It is the depressing part of talking about education policy, because on all sides you find an awful lot of people who are more focused on political calculus than they are on what will actually help education.
What do you think? Now, I have not read Cory Booker's education policy, but he is speaking a lot about public education now. And what do you think about the change in someone like him, who was very, you know, working closely with one of these billionaire donors, Mark Zuckerberg? And that experiment in Newark, New Jersey, which had a ton of money and political will, do you think it benefited the students of Newark?
Oh, that's a hard question, which is a little beyond my expertise. There have certainly been books written about it. For anybody who's concerned about New Jersey, my recommendation is a blog called Jersey Jazz Man, by a guy who lives and works in New Jersey and is great with figures and numbers and great in making them understandable. Jersey Jazz Man is the name of the blog. I don't think the efforts in New Jersey were completely without any positive effects, but I don't think it was. And it's like a lot of things that have been attempted at this point. So many things over the last 15 or 20 years have been attempted as a sort of proof of concept. You know, the pitch has been, give us a couple million dollars, give us a couple of tens of millions of dollars, give us control over the local political machinery, give us the chance to do everything the way we want to do, and this will be awesome. And in 5 or 10 years, we'll be able to hold this up, and it'll be scalable, and it'll spread like wildfire, and everybody will look at it and say, ooh, we want to be like that. You know, New Orleans was supposed to be like that. The state of Michigan was supposed to be like that. New Jersey and Newark were supposed to be like that. Have you heard anybody clamoring to be the next Newark or the next New Orleans or the next Michigan? No, you haven't, because in all cases, there were huge problems. And certainly in Newark, some huge problems around the attempts to reform there, including, as is often typically the case, a failure to really engage with the people who were actually there in that community. This is probably one of the biggest failures of modern education reform over and over and over again. It's something that they swoop in and do to the people of a community rather than doing it with them.
Right. And New Orleans is also a perfect example of that, which New Orleans has no public schools left. They're all chartered in the
Correct.
New Orleans parish. So one of the things that I read on your blog recently was you did a scorecard for Democratic hopefuls.
Oh, yeah.
And it was kind of interesting. And you had these categories, not necessarily putting people into them, but just categories of how you could figure out who's doing a good, who would do a good job for education. And I don't know if you can do this off the top of your head, because it's there were several categories: below basic, basic, proficient, advanced.
Yes.
So if there, let's see, how is there a way you could talk about how you came up with these categories?
Well, the categories are the same categories that we put students in for high stakes testing. We rank students as basic, below basic, proficient, and advanced. And from there, I just looked at the issues and where I would hope to see the candidates fall on particular issues. The challenge for public education has always been that politically we've been something of an orphan. It just isn't an issue. It's been kind of exciting to see it come up as much as it has this year, because generally speaking, it's not an issue that gets brought up. And it's also an issue that the candidates sort of tiptoe around, because it's, for candidates, it used to be safe and easy. You go out there, say, you know, kiss a baby, eat an apple pie, say, we love our teachers, public schools are swell, and you're done. But now you've got to figure out what you want to say about charters, and charters are complicated, and most of the candidates have shown that they don't really understand what's going on there. In the 2016 election, most of the Democrats took the angle of saying, well, we'll talk about universal pre-K, and we'll talk about free or less expensive college.
And K-12 is a blank.
And K-12, we're just not going to go there. We'll say, less testing, because that sounds safe.
What's exciting about this race is, not everyone has put out an education plan, but the chatter about education, about K-12 education, has been like a thousandfold compared to what it was in previous years.
It really has been. It's been exceptional, and that's a great thing to see. I'm paying some attention because I have to write about it, but as I've also written several times, it is, and Democrats would do well to remember, it's July of 2019. Right now, getting my Christmas list taken care of has a greater sense of urgency for me than picking out my Democratic presidential candidate.
My husband would agree with you. He goes, where people are right now has no impact on where they're going to be in 6 months.
They're shifting around. They're testing out messages. That's fine. As a writer, I'm paying attention to some of the more important stuff. I think it was a big deal, for instance, yesterday that Elizabeth Warren actually made a strong, clear statement against high-stakes testing, which is really the first we've heard on that subject from anybody. Bernie Sanders has hinted at it, but he hasn't really hit it head-on.
That's a change for Warren.
Yes, it is a shift for her.
Yes. So we're going to have to take a quick break right now. And when we come back, I want to talk to you about waste and fraud in schools and also ed tech, this creepy ed tech stuff that's going on. We will be right back. We're speaking with Peter Green, and we'll be back in about 2 minutes. Thanks. Oh, hi, we're back. You're listening to... we're talking to Peter Green this morning. I'm your host, Robin Hiller. And Peter is a blogger and writer. He blogs at kermeducationblogspot.com. And he also writes for Forbes and Forbes Magazine and The Progressive, covering all bases. And we're talking about education right now. So I had a question for you about one of the articles you wrote for Forbes. Now, in full disclosure, I am a former board member and staff member of the Network for Public Education, which released a study last spring showing that the Department of Education has spent over $1 billion on charter school waste and fraud. And then, Peter, you wrote an article about the rebuttal that the charter movement wrote about that article on why charter schools, your article was called Why Charter Schools Must Waste Money. And this was about the very different philosophies behind charter schools and public schools. And I'd love for you to talk about that because I had not considered that argument.
One of the rebuttals that was offered to the NPE report was the idea that the report criticized the charter movement for having a lot of schools that close quickly and in some cases don't open at all. And the criticism in response to that was that it wasn't fair to call that a failure. But that to me just kind of reveals or sort of makes explicit one of the differences in philosophy. The charter movement as we currently have it, which is not the way charters have to be, but that's a whole other discussion. But the charter movement as we currently have it is very much in a business philosophy. And it takes the business philosophy that, well, what we do is we set up 10 charter schools. And then two of them fail because of financial reasons, and three of them fail because they can't meet the requirements that their authorizer gave for them. And so we're left with five and maybe two more open. And after this goes on for years and years, then we have a couple of really super duper charters. And that's a business philosophy to it. That's part of the idea that if we have competition, somehow it's going to magically produce better schools. But it speaks to me to what's one of the biggest fallacies behind the charter school movement, which is the idea that somehow we can fund two or three or four or five different parallel school districts with the same money that we used to use to just fund one school district. And this is, nobody does this. If you're having trouble meeting your household budget, you don't sit down with your spouse and say, we're having trouble paying the bills for this house. Let's buy a second house. That should help. Businesses don't say, man, we're really having trouble making ends meet. What we need to do is open a few more facilities. Schools. What are schools, public schools all over the country doing? They're shutting down and combining elementary schools, combining facilities as a way to cut costs. So if you're going to have 10 parallel school districts, then fund them. Don't try to fund them with the money that you use to just fund one school district, particularly if your expectation is that some of those schools are going to close. The idea that I think what I wrote was something effective. Imagine a public school district proposing a tax increase, and when the taxpayers say, what are you going to do with the money? The district just says, well, we plan to lose all of it. That's just part of our process.
True.
And the other part of that idea of just churning schools is that educationally, from a student standpoint, it's a terrible idea. Every time a child is ejected from their school, when they go up to, and in some cases it is as brutal as kids show up for school in the morning and the building is padlocked and there's a notice on the door saying the school's closed. you know, the family has to scramble for another school. The kid has to be, student has to be the new kid in school at another school again. They're split up from the friends and the teachers that they had connected with at their old school. Every time you boot children out of a building and tell them to go find another building to go to school in, that's creating a lot of disruption and upheaval that does not benefit them. But those two effects, the throwing money at schools that we know are not going to work, the upheaval of students, those of us who are kind of connected to public education look at those and see those as a bug. For charter fans, that's a feature. And I've said over and over, you know, the fact that business ethics applied to school, it's not a matter that business ethics are automatically suspect and evil and wrong. It's just that they don't fit the goals of the institution. They don't fit what a public school is there for. Now, public, part of what you expect from a public school is a commitment. You don't go back every year wondering whether your public school is still going to be there or not. The public school says, we will be here as long as we possibly can to take care of our guarantee that every child gets an education. A charter school says, we're going to be here as long as it makes business sense for us to be here.
All right, it's a very different approach. Your discussion of this reminded me of a program we have in Arizona, and it is a grant process for people who want to open charters. And what it is it's $250,000 a year, so you get a group of people together and you apply for this, and the first year is you get $250,000, and that's to think about what you want your charter to do. And the second year is to come up with a plan, an implementation plan, and there's another $250,000. And then the third year is when you might open the doors, and you get $250,000 for that, your team. At any time in the process, you can stop. So you can be thinking about it the first year and get your 250 grand. And then the second year, as you're developing your plan, you go, yeah, not really, not for me. You still get that $250,000. The third year is a little hard to get the $250,000 if you're not doing it. But I just think this fits right into the idea of we're going to try stuff, and if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. You know, we don't have to, like, follow through on educating these kids for K through 12 or educating these kids for the next 20 years. We can think about it and then move on if it's not working for them or for us.
Yeah, these students are not our problem. We can walk away from them at any time. And I think it's worth underlining that the NPE report says, yeah, the federal government has spent around $1 billion. They're continuing to dig down, and it looks like many of their figures were underestimated. But that's the federal government spending $1 billion on charter schools that aren't there. That doesn't even get into the amount of money that is being spent by states or by private philanthropists. I mean, we're, in terms of opportunity cost, we are throwing an awful lot at charter schools that could have accomplished so much in other ways and other places.
Now, so there's charters who are nonprofits and charter. We have very little oversight in Arizona over our charters. And one of the problems we have is charter management organizations. Is that something that you see nationally?
It's a problem nationally. It varies. Now, charter laws vary a little bit from state to state. I said there are ways to rank candidates on education. One of the signs that somebody has not done their homework is when they tell you that, and this was a common line for almost every candidate in 2016, when they tell you that for-profit charters are bad, but non-profit charters are fine.
Right.
and anybody who's telling you that has not done their homework. Non-profit charters are for-profit charters with a good accounting system.
Right. We have one here where the charter management organization is making $7 million a year, the owner of the charter management organization. He's also the chairman of the board of the school.
Right.
Of the nonprofit arm of the school.
Right. If I want to make a few million dollars running a nonprofit charter school, I set up my charter school. I put myself in charge of it. I take my $7 million that comes from the state and the federal government and private philanthropists and whoever, and I hand $6.5 million of that to a charter management organization to run the school for me. And lo and behold, I am also the owner and operator of the charter management organization. Or I have a building that I rent for myself, or I hire myself to do any number of things.
The lawyer or your family is the book supplier or the supplier of goods. We have a legislator in Arizona who, right before last year's election, sold his charter school to a nonprofit that his brother was the head of. And it was estimated he was going to get between $13 and $25 million. But it's the same. And then the brother, the nonprofit brother, hired him to run the school.
Right.
And that guy got reelected. That was the shocking part for me.
Well, and there are several states that operate like that. You see a lot of that in Florida, too, where as a legislator, we write the rules that govern how charters work, and then we run charters ourselves. Or you have your wife run a charter, or your brother run a charter, and you're on all sides of the equation, so you can make sure that the money goes where you need it to go.
Yes. So charters, vouchers, any other forms of privatization we need to talk about?
The other thing that vouchers come in a couple of different flavors now because they're not terribly popular strictly as vouchers. Besides the vouchers, which is a voucher, I give your family basically a ticket and you go and cash that in at whatever school you want to send your child to. There are the tax scholarship credits, which we already discussed, where my business gives money directly to the school it wants to support instead of paying taxes. And there's also something called education savings accounts, which is where if I'm a family, the state gives me, say, a debit card with whatever it's really a voucher amount, but we're gonna call it an ASA, and the state gives me a debit card with, say, $3,000 on it, and I can spend that on whatever educational thing I want. I can spend it on tuition to a private school, if there's enough there. I can spend it on books for homeschooling. Depending on the state where I've done this, I can spend it on educational trips, or educational software, or special therapy. They've run into problems in some cases because, generally speaking, again, there's not a lot of oversight. How does the state know that the family is spending the money on proper educational stuff? In some cases, they just don't. But that's another way of moving the money around.
Well, here, one of the ways it's not called vouchers is we have empowerment scholarship accounts. And you're right, there is no accountability. Last year, there was a kind of expose on this where they found that some parents who are homeschooling their children who get the money that would ordinarily go to a school had bought trucks, had bought sock monkeys. That was the thing that made everyone go ballistic, the sock monkey purchase. But they'd also bought cars for themselves to transport their children. But and probably they used it for other things, I'm not sure. But there is no reporting. There's no oversight committee that looks at this and says, huh, that doesn't seem like an educational expense.
No, that seems to be pretty common with ESAs, which aren't quite as widespread, but that's exactly the problem. It's one of the reasons that I find it surprising that there aren't more conservatives on the anti side of these things. As a conservative, one of the conservative objections to spending tax dollars on public schools is that they don't like how public schools spend them. Well, with an ESA, you're handing money out and you've got no accountability at all. Someone's taking your tax dollars, giving it to a family. What did the family do with it? We don't know.
Exactly. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I'd like to talk to you about EdTech. And we'll be back in just a second. I'm speaking with Peter Green. Hi, we're back. You're listening to Smart Talk. I'm your host, Robin Hiller. Al is not in today. And I am speaking with Peter Green, who blogs at curmudgeocation.blogspot.com. He also writes for Forbes Magazine and The Progressive, and also has a Twitter account, which at the moment I can't find. It's Peter, can you tell us your Twitter account?
I'm at Palan, P-A-L-A-N, 57.
Okay, great. One of the things I wanted to ask you about is, you wrote something that was so science fiction-y, this creepy, freaky column about EdTech from the surveillance state. And one of the things you wrote was that there is software that claims it will read student facial expressions and eye movements and engage the social and emotional well-being of students. This is like, if you saw this in a movie, people would be horrified.
There's a lot of this stuff out there. There's a lot of it coming. If you want to see how scary it can get, just look at China, where the level of surveillance tied into facial recognition software, tied into an actual social responsibility score. Basically, the state watches you, tracks all of your behavior and activities, who you hang out with, and it gives you a score on how good a citizen you are. And then that score affects things like, can you get a house loan? Can you get better consideration for this job you're up for? And in China, much of this stuff is already there. It's already happening. In this country, we've seen one of the next big things in education is an emphasis on social and emotional learning. So we're seeing more software that promises ways to track the social and emotional state of students. And by following eye movements, by one that I just read about and just wrote about is a company that will use audio monitoring. It will listen to what's going on in the classroom and tell you if somebody's getting so stressed that they might be a threat. Some of this stuff is, the history of EdTech is the history of grotesquely overpromising things. Things that we swear we're going to be able to do and we can't. It's a whole other conversation, but we continue as an English teacher, we've seen for 20 or 30 years the promise that we've got some software here that will assess student writing for you. And they keep promising it and they keep rolling it out and it keeps turning out to be junk. We've got, and I've seen this, I've worked with this in my own classroom, some of the standardized computer-based testing now, one of the companies, NWEA, the folks who bring you the MAP test, will tell you whether your student is engaged in the test or not, and a variety of other things they think they can tell you based strictly on how long the student waits before they answer a question. Basically, they're just measuring the amount of time between the last time the student clicked on an answer and the time they clicked on this answer.
What if you're a slow answer or fast answer? You know, what if, I mean, that implies that everyone has the same process for figuring out their answer.
Well, I think their answer there is that they're looking for variation in your usual pattern, but the answer is they don't know. And with lots of this tech, you don't ever get a real answer because it's proprietary and they don't want to tell you how they figured out certain things or didn't figure out certain things.
See, this is what's shocking to me, is that people aren't, just like with the testing and, you know, sharing information with corporations about students, that there isn't an uprising about this invasion into students' privacy and their parents at the same time.
Yeah, it is scary the degree to which we accept this, and I think part of it is that people don't necessarily see it. I mean, and it's fairly simple. Anything that goes through a computer can be recorded by the computer, and if it can be recorded, then that becomes data that's valuable to somebody. But we're also, at this point, socialized to be used to it. I mean, people will talk about how they don't want to have their data invaded, and then they'll go log on Facebook and give it all away for free. And I think to some extent, people don't understand how extensive the reach of big data is and what big data thinks they can do with it. I mean, it's partly scary to me that Big Brother exists and we've all signed up for him. But also that Big Brother, as we currently have him, is not super good at his job. There's an awful lot of stuff that all of this data mining and data gathering doesn't get right. But it's not protected. You know, a week doesn't go by that we don't see some story from some large repository of personal information being hacked.
Yes.
And it does get sold and passed around. You know, one of the, seems like a small thing, but it was an eye-opening experience for me. I worked at a call center for a catalog company where we took orders that people called in. That was one of my summer jobs as a teacher. But one of the things I learned there was that the company's biggest source of income was not selling merchandise. Their biggest source of income was selling their customer list.
Yeah.
So anything that can collect data from you is collecting data from you. And children are a prime target because they have no sensitivity to it at all, and they're a captive audience, and you can get everybody. So they are today's gold rush.
Well, one of the things, I have a grandchild who's in middle school, and he's had the same teacher, English teacher, for 2 years, and she's had them reading dystopian novels for 2 years. So I'm hoping the middle school children will save us.
We can hope.
Yes. And I also want to thank you for being a high school teacher. And I know you didn't teach middle school, but I think high school teachers and middle school teachers are the saints of the universe.
Well, thank you. I think that about elementary teachers.
Yes, but the children are nicer. So I want to thank you for coming on. And also, I just want to mention to people who are listening out there how they can get a hold of you if they want. Your blog is kermeducation.blogspot.com, that you can find articles in Forbes magazine and also in The Progressive. And on another note, on Thursday, the NEA interviewed 10 Democratic hopefuls about education, and you can find this on YouTube, on PBS.org, and it's called 2020 Democrats Answer Questions at National Education Association Forum. And I've only seen half of it, but it's very fascinating. Is there anything you'd like to say before we close off? Anything that I've missed?
Oh, no, that was plenty. But thank you very much for having me on.
Okay. Oh, we did miss Betsy DeVos, unfortunately. Another time.
Well, I'm happy to miss her.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming on. And we will be back next week with Al Bergeson from Social Behavioral Sciences. Thank you for joining us.